Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started. On this week's episode of White Wine Question Time.
Everything changed later in 2011 with the viral clip of Bradley Walsh corpsing over a German skier called Fanny Schmeller. And that, whoever wrote that question changed our lives. That day, Don Ward, who owns the comedy store, he rang my house while I was on call at Newham General. And he spoke to my housemate, Dave, and said, how can I get hold of Paul Sinha? Dave said you have to ring Newham General and ask them to bleep Dr. Sinha. And he did. He rang up Newham General Hospital and asked them to bleep me. I don't need to gamble to get my highs. I get my highs from engaging with the world either online or in reality. And that boredom that led me to the betting shops in the first place just doesn't exist. There's no excuse to be bored.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week describes himself as, quote, the only openly gay British Asian qualified doctor and television quizzer on the UK comedy circuit. He's also one of the six chasers on ITV's The Chase and can currently be seen with his husband Oliver on Celebrity Gogglebox. Born in Luton to parents who'd emigrated to the UK from Calcutta in 1968, 2 years before he was born, his dad was a doctor and his mother a nurse. He was educated at Dulwich College before going on to study medicine, as was the family way, at St George's Hospital Medical School, where comedy medic Harry Hill had studied before him. But it was here his path in life changed course, thanks in no small part the student bar. He started performing stand-up there whilst he was working as a junior doctor, debuting at the Edinburgh Festival in 2004, where he's returning this summer, some 19 years later, with his new show, Paulie Bengali, a nod to his 2019 Parkinson's diagnosis. As well as his work as a stand-up, he's also a British quiz champion and, of course, has been on The Chase for 12 years now. And let me tell you, he's ridiculously good in the hot seat, I should know. I've been up against him and I've got the bruised ego to prove it. I'm really looking forward to talking to him rather than being thrashed by him. So let's dial him in, shall we? It's Paul Sinha. How are you, sir?
Oh, very well. The weather's picked up a little bit from yesterday and I'm in a lovely hotel in Ascot chatting to you and I'm very well indeed.
You're in Ascot?
Yeah, I've got a after-dinner speaking job this evening in Ascot, so we decided to stay in a hotel here for a couple of days.
Oh, nice. bit of a mini break with Oliver, who, by the way, has been a genius setting up the tech for this call. So thank you to Oliver.
Oliver is a technical genius.
He's a good man, isn't he?
He's a very, very good man indeed. I'm not sure how I'd cope without him. I got married just in time. Just in time.
What did you describe him as to me previously?
A pound shop David Furnish, which is perhaps unfair given how absolutely dependent I am on his skills.
Exactly. And plus the cost of living as well, Paul. Let's not forget that.
Well, exactly, yes.
So you're off to Edinburgh again with your husband, who goes to as many shows as he can because he's also a voracious showgoer and quizzer, isn't he?
He is. He always says, I'm not a quizzer in the same sense. And that's really like a knife in my back because the number of times he actually beats me at quiz, including the most recent World Championships and a couple of British Championships. He has taken my scalp on a few occasions. So when he tells people he's not a quizzer in the same sense, and I know that he's kind of telling the truth and that he doesn't take it quite as seriously as I do, it is like a knife in the back that he beats me as many times as he does.
I can't. How do you resolve the fallout from one of you winning? Because
there's never any fallout.
There's not.
No, there's never. We're very supportive of each other. In many ways, I'm more supportive. And I'm more excited when he does really well than he is when I do really well.
Really.
Because he does it for fun, so other people's results don't really bother him. He's quite above all of that competitiveness, and is a pure quizzer who does it for the love of facts, whereas I'm still trying to do it to win stuff and score points. And it's really, really annoying when he beats me because I know that he doesn't take it as seriously as I do.
Yeah, his heart's not quite as in it to the same degree.
No.
How's it been appearing together on Gogglebox?
It's been... Every day is a learning day, isn't it? It doesn't matter where you are in your career. Every day is a learning day. It's so different from what we're used to. But we've been told to be ourselves, and that's very much what we're being. There's no... what's the word? I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but there's no acting up or playing up to the cameras. We are an unusual couple. We are a quiet, nerdy, fat-guzzling couple for whom a lot of television that we watch is not really to our tastes. and certainly the few weeks we've done it, we've watched a lot of very bad television, and Below Deck and the new Colombian telenovela Fake Profile, two of the worst shows I've ever seen in my life, I'll be honest with you.
And of course, you're kind of force-fed this, aren't you? Because you've got to watch it so that they can capture your responses.
Yes. And it can be very interesting because sometimes we're just looking at it going, I have no engagement with this whatsoever. This is not my telly. And of course, the nature of the show is there's a lot of reality TV and a lot of... game shows, and so there's...
I thought you'd like the game shows.
Yeah, I do like... the game shows are fine, because they've got a play-along factor.
Yeah.
But there's some of the reality TV has got no play-along factor whatsoever. You're just sitting there going, I don't care about these people or what they do with their lives. I just can't bring myself to care.
You're not reaching to vote to save any of them from eviction?
No, absolutely.
No.
They can all be evicted as far as I'm concerned. I liked Is It Cake is on this week, and I like that. Although you don't get close enough to the cakes to know exactly which one's a cake and which one isn't.
When I see shows like that, I do think, how did that pitch meeting go?
How does any pitch meeting go, let's be honest? It's a random process these days as to what's a success and what isn't.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is down to just catching a vibe or catching a wave.
I mean, you as the cineman, one of your many... stage personas for The Chase. I mean, you've had an incredible run on that show. 12 years.
Yeah. I joined in, 12 years ago, 2011. And I was just delighted to be quizzing on telly. I had no greater ambition than to show off on telly. I didn't think I was going to become famous on the back of it. Far from it. We were getting figures of about 1.5, 1.8 million a day. And we weren't really a talked about show. And everything changed later in 2011 with the viral clip of Bradley Walsh corpsing over a German skier called Fanny Schmeller. And that whoever wrote that question changed our lives. It literally changed our lives. Because that was the mechanism by which everybody started talking about The Chase.
Are you serious? That was the moment.
Fanny.
Absolutely.
What's her name?
Fanny Schmeller. She's now retired.
What was Fanny Schmeller's job? Sorry.
She was a skier. And she's now retired, but Brad corpsing over, much as you're corpsing over the name of the moment. Perhaps you'll go for the viral market.
Do you know what? I just didn't see that coming. I'm sorry, it slightly knocked me off kilter. But brilliant. So Fanny Schmeller really is what tipped the chase into becoming part of our kind of TV fabric, because that's what it is now. It's daytime, it's prime time, it's just the chase. It's, you know, everyone knows what the chase is. Even if they don't watch it, they know it.
I mean, the chase has got a lot of things going for it. The persona of the chase is the questions, the gameplay, which can be very thrilling at the end. But the thing that everyone knows the chase for is Bradley's rapport with the general public, and Bradley being the ringmaster who can hold any chaos together. And that was never proven more accurate in the Fanny Schmeller moment. It just taught everyone that Bradley is a figure to be loved and applauded and celebrated. And that's what really got the show onto the radar of the general public.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's hands down one of the best in the business.
Indeed.
When you come onto the show, obviously, like, we don't get to know, as you stand there with Brad, you don't know who's coming out. Well, I never did. We did really well. We had £86,000 until Anne absolutely spanked us.
Well, you didn't have £86,000 there, did you?
No, you're quite right.
You had a dream of £86,000.
It was on the board. Do you know what I mean?
But that, what a horrible thing to do at Christmas as well.
That's what I said.
Very, very much the Ebenezer Scrooge of our days.
And remarkably, when I said to her afterwards, do you feel bad? Because, you know, that's a lot of money for charity. She just said no.
Well, we can't feel bad. We do sort of feel bad, but we can't, because it's our job. And we signed up to do the job. And if that means ruining everyone's Christmas, so be it. rather than that, than lose.
Well, I hope that I've compiled for you today, put three thought-provoking questions. Shall we dive in and start with question number one?
Why not? I hope it's not general knowledge.
With you, I wouldn't even dare. Now, we often credit people with being life-changing, or events in our life being life-changing. But I'd like to talk to you about the places that have proved to be life-changing for you. For example, the bar at St. George's, which went on to completely remap the course you took in life. So can we walk through some of your most seminal venues in life?
Wow, what a great question. I think the one that changed my life more than anything else is the Comedy Store in London.
Really?
It's the most legendary comedy club in the world, along with the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, on which it was based. And in December 1998... I was on call for obstetrics and gynaecology at Newham General Hospital, because I was being a junior doctor and a part-time comedian at the same time. And that day, Don Ward, who owns the Comedy Store, found that he had a spot missing for the following week to do the five-minute open spot, the unpaid spot where you try and make a name. And he went through his list of people that he could ring up, and he rang my house number up. He rang my house, but I was on call at Newham General. And he spoke to my housemate, Dave, and said, how can I get hold of Paul Sinha? And Dave said, you have to ring Newham General and ask them to bleep Dr. Sinha. And he did. He rang up Newham General Hospital and asked them to bleep me. And so I was examining either a baby or a patient on the ward when I got a message from the ward sister station saying that Don Ward from the Comedy Store is on the phone. And I got the shock of my life, and I went over, and he booked me for that spot the following week. And as sometimes can happen when you're only doing 5 minutes of comedy, absolutely nailed it. Absolutely nailed the five-minute spot. It's the first time I'd ever been there. I'd heard all about it, but I'd never actually visited the Comedy Store until my first ever gig there. And the same night, an agent who saw me from the back of the room swooped in and said, I really like what you're doing there. I'd like to represent you. And so I walked into the Comedy Store that Thursday night, a totally unknown, and at that stage, I think my total career earnings were about £75 total in comedy. And I walked out a man with an agent.
Wow.
So, and I got the gig by accident, because I was just on a list of random phone numbers of people that he had, that Don Ward had. So recently I did a solo show at the Comedy Store. Not many people get to do a solo show at the Comedy Store, because you have to hire the venue yourself and do all the organisation yourself. and it's famous for like shows with 5 to 8 comedians on. And to come back 25 years later, after that break, and come back and do a solo show, just filled me with such massive pride. And it's really where I learnt over the years through their support. I learnt the trade of being a good comedian more than probably any other club, was the Comedy Store.
Wow.
But I got my first break in such a fortuitous circumstance.
Isn't that just?
Yeah. And the George's Bar is the other one. But for a number of reasons, really. So I joined medical school as an 18-year-old. And at that stage in my life, I'd never been drunk. I was a classic nerdish, quiet, lacking in confidence, closet gay virgin. And that's how I arrived at medical school. And by the time I left medical school, 6.5 years later, I was a problem drinking, problem gambling, quiz machine emptying, heavy drinking, totally different human being with confidence and life skills and friends. And the whole environment at St. George's Hospital Medical School allowed me to not just to come out as a gay man, but to come out in so many other ways in terms of developing a personality and confidence. And many of my happiest moments rather were spent in that environment. And oddly enough, because you asked this, rather like the Comedy Store, I revisited it again because I recently did a talk at the medical school.
Well, there's a stage there that you named after you now, isn't there? The Paul Sinner stage.
Yes, and there is a stage there. And you don't think, because I was statistically one of the worst medical students that place had ever seen. You don't think that one day they're going to name something after you because you became a success as a comedian. So it's quite nice. They don't judge people necessarily by their academic record, but by the other things they've achieved as well.
But that's what a remarkable transformation you underwent in so many ways under the roof at St. George's. You know, like you said, the boy that arrived and the man that left were really quite remarkably different.
Yeah, not necessarily happier, but different.
Yeah, I mean, you did a lot. You discovered a lot. You tend to go at stuff very hard, don't you? So I imagine, like, when you gambled, you really gambled. I would imagine when you drink, you really drink.
Have you been talking to my best friends, Kate? Because you seem to be knowledgeable about my life in a way that I don't find typical of an interviewer. You seem to know it all. Yes, I'm somebody that went at life very hard. And I think that was, if I'm being serious for a second, a sort of reflection of how things that teenagers end up doing as adults, because they never had any responsibility as a teenager and they're always a bit pampered. And so I think if I'd got myself a Saturday job as a teenager, learnt to be thrifty with my own money that I'd worked hard to earn, had more responsibilities, knew a little bit more about life, maybe being drunk at 17 rather than waiting till 18, that sort of thing. But had a bit more preparation in real life before I went to medical school. I think sometimes the freedom and liberty of being a student can be totally overwhelming if you haven't enjoyed any aspect of that previously.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a common thing that a lot of students go through, is that they react by going a bit wild.
Well, you're like a hungry man at an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yes, exactly.
And then, of course, the quizzing came along, and that kind of started to feed into the way that you approached everything, including your comedy. And never more so than really when you made your debut at Edinburgh. Would Edinburgh be a place that has a special kind of significance in terms of venues? I know you've probably played multiple venues there, but the Fringe itself.
I have played multiple venues, and last year was my favourite venue. It was the basement of the Newtown Theatre in George Street. And because I was bringing music, and my favourite band is the Pet Shop Boys, the fact that this place had low ceilings and seemed like the perfect place to watch the Pet Shop Boys sort of energised me. It was a really, I can't recommend the venue highly enough. It's air conditioned. It's not steamily hot. Great acoustics, low ceiling. And I've chosen to forego this year my perfect room to do something bigger. So because that had 200 seats, and this year I'm going for 400 seats, because I think if you don't get a chance to dream, When will you? I'm going for a 400 seater purely because I'd like to go for a big room 1 year of my life, and this seems to be the right year to go about it. But the dream room was very much last year. The Stand Comedy Club, who have been operating stand-up comedy in Edinburgh for donkey's years now, have always treated me really, really well. Fair financial deals, great support, and they're not a place as such. Well, there is a Stand Comedy Club, but they're more than that. They're an institution, they're an organisation, they're an ethos of treating acts fairly. And I couldn't be where I am now without their help and support over the years.
So that's a very, very special place.
Very well. And Edinburgh is a magnificent city. But I'll be honest with you, it's just as magnificent outside of the festival. In many ways, it's more so because you can get tables at restaurants. Yeah. And, the Edinburgh of the other 11 months of the year seems like an almost completely different city. Mm. And it's as far as I'm aware, it's just as enjoyable.
Yeah. What about the place that you chose to propose to Oliver? Did that have great meaning and significance?
Well, again, this is a slightly weird story in that I got dumped in 2015 by boyfriend number one. And that autumn, I spent a night drinking with my cousin in Rome. And we randomly walked the streets of Rome. We suddenly found ourselves on a bridge over the River Tiber. And I looked at the view. I thought, my God, this would be a nice place to propose to someone one day. And I never actually, you know, I'd just been dumped. The idea that that one person could ever be me doing the proposal hadn't even occurred to me. I just thought the view was lovely. Isn't this romantic? La-di-da-di-da. I ended up on that bridge 4 years later, proposing to Oliver, and it wasn't even deliberate. I wanted to propose to him at the Piazza Navona, where the Fountain of the Four Rivers is, mm-hmm. and I wanted to propose to him there, but there were armed police everywhere because it was just after Christmas, and European capital cities are very much on high terror alert during the Christmas period. So there were armed police everywhere, and I thought, this is not a romantic environment. And so I just said, Oliver, let's go for a walk. And we just walked and walked and walked. And I was looking around, looking for the perfect place. So I decided it had to be somewhere around it. And then to my astonishment, I found myself on the exact bridge. It was a complete accident.
Oh, wow.
I found myself on the exact bridge that I stood on with my cousin 4 years previously. So it was an extraordinary coincidence, really.
Wow. And there it was. And obviously, as we know, he went on to say yes. Congratulations.
He did. Within a second, when you say he went on to say yes, it sounds like he hesitated. He didn't hesitate. He was,
it was like a
that was
fast finger round. Yep, in, done.
that would have been a nice touch.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Are you ready for your next question?
Yeah.
But question number two, I wanted to revisit one of my favourite tweets that I found on your feed. You and Oliver started dating back in 2016, and in 2020, you posted about how your father found out about your relationship, tweeting a picture of Oliver at the till in Sainsbury's with your dad queuing behind him. You wrote, 2016, 2 months into dating, we go to Sainsbury's. Me, be prepared, we might bump into my dad and he doesn't know about you. Then, and there we have it, the two of them almost shoulder to shoulder and you mortified. I mean, how did it play out? And also, when else in life have you lost control of the narrative and had big news taken out of your hands?
How did it play out? He was a little bit surprised. This would have been about, more than a year after I'd been dumped. But they were so upset that I'd lost the happiness of a long-term relationship the previous year that I didn't want to get their hopes up high during the early part of the relationship. I wanted to see how it went. And that's the only reason I hadn't told them, is I didn't want them to jump up and down with joy and then find out that the relationship hadn't gone anywhere. So I wanted to be cemented in the relationship before I told my dad. Now, I live about a mile and a half from that particular Sainsbury's. My dad lives about a mile and a half from that particular Sainsbury's in a different direction. And I knew that they were shopping there regularly at the time, because we keep in touch regularly. But the statistical chance of bumping into him was so low that I'd kind of said to Oliver, almost as a joke, by the way, there's a possibility we might bump into my dad. The idea that he would end up in the same queue without realising that he was in the same queue. I was at the till and I looked up and I was like, oh my, what? I was so totally confused. And I went, hello, Dad. And he was completely confused as to what I was doing there because he thinks I don't even ever go to the supermarket, that I only eat takeaways. So he was a bit surprised. He was a bit surprised to see me there. And it was a genuinely beautiful moment of introducing a new boyfriend to my dad and him being very happy. But I was absolutely curious as to why I hadn't told him anything thus far.
That's quite a gap, isn't it?
That is quite a gap. But one of the biggest coincidental things that happened in my life. But as in terms of losing the narrative, all the time you lose the narrative, really. Life is complex and people gossip, and I suspect that what you're alluding to is how I came out.
No, not at all. Just like when else you've had maybe big news that, you know, you've like the proposal, you planned it one way, it ended up playing out another. Sometimes as well, we need the narrative to be taken out of our control, because otherwise we don't do anything with it. Your relationship with Oliver, with you not telling your dad.
Well, this one's less happy. I came out to my mum because somebody at a house party at our house rang my mum from our house phone and said, your son's gay, and put the phone down. That is how she found out that I was gay. I could laugh about it now.
Oh my God, that's not funny. How old were you?
24.
And they'd phoned your mum. So there was some sort of boozy prank in their mind.
Boozy prank is the exact definition of what it was, yes.
Was it an act of malice, do you think, or just somebody?
It didn't land well, the news. And I laugh about it now. And obviously with comedy, you write about the darkness as well as the light. And so I've written material about it now and got laughs out of it. But it was a pretty stressful time to be alive, to be honest with you, there and then, because you have your own ideas of how it may happen. And as you said, there was an element of, well, thank God somebody said it, but it was a bit early. I came out to my dad in 2005, and he was very pragmatic and positive and supportive about it. But that 11 years is a lot of years. And if I'd come out to him in 1994, I don't know whether he'd have been the same. We'll never know. We'll never know. And there's an element of maybe I was right to leave it till 2005 in terms of the progress in society and the different way that people look at hope, sexuality. Maybe he needed to wait. My mum never got that option.
So she found out but never told your dad?
Yes.
Wow. So that puts another layer of secrecy in the family that hadn't been there.
Yes, very much so.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot. And it all ended happily. But, you know, eventually me and Oliver got married in 2019. They were there. They were supportive. They were lovely. They enjoyed the whole occasion. Everybody is at peace. But to get to that peace, there's a lot of rocky roads on the way. And it wasn't fun.
No, I can imagine that was not fun. And deeply unkind, even if it wasn't done with intent.
I still don't know who it was, because there were so many different candidates, because that's the nature of my friendships. My friends, we were all bad drunks.
And so you were there and you were drunk as well. And then you know that that's happened. And then what? That must have been the quickest sobering up of your life, Paul.
Well, it was the next morning that my mum rang me up and told me about it. So I didn't know it happened there and then. I found out the next day. And so that was quite something. Yeah, sometimes you quite spectacularly lose the narrative of your life, because that's very much the way that humans interact. No one can keep a secret.
But also the narrative of where you were going to go in life changed and was taken not out of your control, but you re-navigated when you went to medical school and started to discover comedy and something that you hadn't even considered being anything other than a doctor, had you? Because that was kind of the family profession.
I look back upon that time a lot and think to myself, I was just one of these people, and there's a lot of us around, who is perfectly smart but has no idea what he wants to do with it. So medicine became the convenient choice, because there was a job at the end of it, because my dad was a doctor, my granddad was a doctor, my mum was a trained nurse and then a midwife. I come from a very medical family. My dad is part of a generation of West Bengalis who became doctors in India and arrived in the United Kingdom in the 50s, 60s and 70s, not just to make money and work in medicine, but to set up home and produce mini versions of themselves. And so it was kind of assumed, because I was a clever kid, that I would become a doctor. But nobody really spotted that it wasn't my area of expertise. I was actually more into language and arts. And what confused the issue was that I was very, very good at maths indeed. And if you're very good at maths, everyone will assume you're very good at science. Mm. And for me, that wasn't the case. I was quite average at science. So when I got to medical school, I was always struggling. A lot of people labelled me as lazy, but I would say that you would be lazy if you were struggling with the subject matter as much as I would. Then the default setting might be to become lazy as a result, because it was frazzling your brain. Add to that the aforementioned liberation and enjoying London and enjoying life. And I never quite got the hang of medical school and everything, the responsibility that entailed, because these exams are really, really difficult. Unless you intrinsically love the subject with passion, it's really tough. Really, you know, imagine doing a degree course in something you didn't love. And it turns out to be one of the most difficult degree courses
out there. And also, it's not like, you know, there aren't consequences to getting it wrong when you start practicing on the job, because there are.
Exactly, yeah. And I find it incredible, looking back on my lifestyle now, to know that I did those jobs. I was, in my first house job at St Helier's Hospital, I was the only urologist on the hospital on a Saturday or a Sunday. Any urological emergencies went to me, a barely qualified new doctor. I've put a pacemaker into a woman's heart at 4 a.m. under guidance. I've looked after I've been the ward doctor in the special care baby unit at Newham General Hospital for 3 months. I've done big jobs, and it shocks me now to think that was my life, because it seems now such a distant past, and my life is now standing on stage in front of drunk people in Middlesbrough on a Saturday night or wherever, or today doing an awards presentation in Ascot. The life seems so different now. But it's a miracle. It's a miracle that I managed to get out of medicine and do find myself in a job that I genuinely really loved. Because I don't know what it's like now when people start comedy. When I started comedy in 1995... very few comedians had ambition. They felt like they were doing it as a sort of, like, you might bungee jump or parachute jump or just a life experience to tick off the box. And in the early years, I remember a few comedians that I gigged with who absolutely made it and had them, Jeannie Yashere, Mickey Flanagan, Lee Mack, Johnny Vegas. I remember some comedians who were newer acts when I started, who then became massive. But most of the people I was gigging with my first two or three years never made it, because it wasn't... It's not seen as it is now necessarily as a springboard to fame and fortune.
It's become a big money business as well now. When you look at the fact that you know, Peter Kay can do 20 nights at the O2 with none of the overheads and costs that would be incurred by, say, a band, right? It's just a man, a mic. The profits are huge, and the business has changed. It's a bit like football. It's become, you know, especially in the upper echelons of it. I guess it's a very different business to the one that you joined, but one that I'm sure you still find really fascinating.
I do a lot of solo shows, and I love doing solo shows, but I still think there's something really pure about banging out 20 to 25 minutes in front of a contained audience who haven't just come out to see you. I think you can believe your own hype when people come to see you, because there's an inherent love in the room for you already. But when you're one of various acts on the bill, it's a bit purer, because you're not being judged as the cineman or the guy off the telly. You're being judged for the jokes that you bring, the jokes that you bring to the occasion. And I've had a run of club gigs in the last week or so that have been really, really viscerally thrilling for me, because they're not been easy.
So for you, you still love being part of an ensemble bill.
Yeah,
where
absolutely.
People have come to see funny people, but not necessarily you.
Yeah, that's my favourite sort of thing, to be honest with you.
You ready for your third and final question?
Yeah.
I found a quote from you that I'd love to unpick if we can. You've said, "The mistakes you make in your life lead on to great things because they lead to twists of fates that change your lives in different ways." And you're absolutely right. So how has that been the case for you over the years? And which mistakes played out well for you in the end, the curses that ultimately became some of life's blessings?
Well, that's an excellent question. And really, these can be answered by my wedding as much as anything else. The fact that I got married, for a start, is because I had a disastrous end to a first relationship where, fundamentally, my first boyfriend decided that he was not of the sexuality that he thought he was.
So he thought he was straight.
Yeah. And so if that hadn't happened...
That's a lot, isn't it, Paul, to get your head around?
That is a lot to get your head around. Mm. If that hadn't happened, I'd have never got married. I don't think I'd ever got married. But it all really starts with choosing medicine as a 15-year-old and then going to medical school and struggling and making friends with fellow strugglers. So I had three best men at my wedding. First of all, a guy called Duncan Johnson, who I would not have been friends with if I hadn't failed my first year exams and had to resit them. And then as a result of dropping a year, I became very good friends with this guy, Duncan.
Great. So that curse became a great blessing.
First of my best men. The second of my best men is a guy called Dave Dewar. Dave Dewar I knew because he was a junior doctor with me in King's Lynn. And I'd never have even been to King's Lynn if I hadn't failed my medical finals and therefore not got the job that I was meant to get, which was to do one of my house jobs in Plymouth. I was meant to be a house officer in Plymouth. And I think that if I'd been to Plymouth, because a lot of doctors fall in love with their first provincial post,
yeah,
I'd probably be a GP somewhere in Devon. That's what I imagine my alternative sliding doors life to be, is a GP somewhere in Devon. So... and my third best man is a more conventional. His name's Manish, but his surname is Sinha, and he's unrelated to me.
Wow!
But he was another one of my best mates in medical school. And the reason we met, we know each other, is because he failed his A levels first time round, and therefore dropped a year and became in my year at medical school. So my three best friendships in terms of best men at the wedding were through mistakes that are made in life. And if you try and create narratives from your mistakes,
yeah,
then they don't become mistakes. They just become things that happen. The one thing that I would say that I would put down as no good came from that, and you mentioned it previously, was the gambling addiction. I can't think of anything positive that came from the gambling addiction. And when people say, what would you say to your 16-year-old self? What I would say is never, ever, ever walk into a betting shop in your life. Because I don't, that's the one avenue of error where I don't think any positivity came out of it at all. Just a lot of financial losses.
Yeah.
So it's not that every bad event has a sliding doors silver lining. It's just that most of them do.
But playing devil's advocate, as you addressed your issues with gambling, you gave more time and attention to quizzing and started to find similar highs from that as an experience. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think so.
Increase your appetite for quizzing rather than gambling?
I think about gambling a lot, because at its worst, I was very bad indeed. And now I can walk past a betting shop and not even have the slightest inclination to walk in. And I think fundamentally, I'm not bored anymore. And the reason I'm not bored is we have something called a smartphone. We have a device that's in our hands. And in our hands is a device that allows you to connect with the entire world, whether it's on social media, whether it's on Wikipedia, whether it's emailing people, whether it's finding out about who built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, whether it's just sticking on your Spotify and exploring the Beatles' third album. The whole world is in your hands. And when I was such a curious kid when it came to information and exploring the world. When my parents went shopping, they'd just drop me off at the bookshop and then come back 4 hours later, going, "Oh, you're still here." And I'll be my head in a book about cricket. If someone had told me, the younger version of myself, that one day you'd have a device in your hand that would just allow you to access the entire world, that's why I don't gamble. I don't need to gamble to get my highs. I get my highs from engaging with the world, either online or in reality. And that boredom that led me to the betting shops in the first place just doesn't exist. There's no excuse to be bored. This is something I'm absolutely evangelical about, is that everything that you might be interested in or might help you connect can be found online. If your thing is that you like to build model railways to carry miniature teddy bears, you'll find a group called Model Railways and Miniature Teddy Bears.
It's all there. Wasn't when we were teenagers.
Not at all, no.
I mean, you talked about getting paged there to get your gig at the comedy club. That's because that's how people contacted you back then.
Exactly.
It wasn't just doctors that had pagers. It was, that was your business comms, really, wasn't it? If you're out of the office, oh, just page me and I'll find a phone box.
Well, I think a lot of people say, oh, so kids these days are always on their phone. Well, if you were a kid back then and you had a phone, you'd always be on your phone. It's not necessarily a bad thing to always be on your phone. Yes, we should all look around, smell the flowers, look at the buildings, etc., etc. We should all, pay more attention to the world around us. But also, it's a magic device that allows you to pay the attention to not just the world around us, but the world beyond where we live as well. And I think that's one of the things that's made quizzing so much harder, is we now need to know everything. In the 1980s, it was all in a book or on telly, what you needed to know. If someone could pick the special subject of television on a quiz show and they'd be asked questions about, you need to be a question of Coronation Street, EastEnders, Dallas, Dynasty, game shows, quiz shows, all creatures. You could list about 25 things that you'd definitely get written questions about. If someone picks telly now, you don't know if it's the second series of White Lotus, if it's whether it's something like Hollyoaks. You have no idea what you're going to get asked questions on. The day before yesterday, I buzzed in on a question that started 456, and I buzzed in and said Squid Game, and got it correct because I knew how many contestants there are at the beginning. I've never watched an episode of Squid Game, but I knew this was the magic number of contestants they had on Squid Game. So the sheer variety of what you need to know now is just enormous, and that's a really, really good thing. The world is so much broader and so much more exciting than it was.
How do you hold all of that information? How do you hold all of that information? Because when I'm studying, like if I'm reading up on an interview, I will know as much as I possibly can about you before we sit down. And then once the interview's done, I have to free that RAM up in my head for the next person, you know? But you seemingly have this like enormous capacity for just storing facts.
Okay, so the answer is you don't. You just hope for the best.
Really?
There's a famous quizzer called Olav Bjortoft, who's currently one of the eggheads, who came up with the lottery ticket theory of knowledge, which is that facts are lottery tickets. The more you buy, the more chance you've got of winning. You'll still lose nearly all the time. But the more tickets you buy, you're trying to score more points than the next person. You're not looking for perfection. At the World Quizzing Championships in June, the winner scored 175, I think, out of 240. So there were 65 questions that the World Quizzing Champion got wrong.
Okay, and that's a comforting stat.
And yeah. he was playing out of his skin. So the answer is don't worry about it. Don't worry about how you, unless you really, really, really want to devote yourself obsessively to not having a life.
Not at this stage, Paul, no.
Well, exactly. And there was about 2 years where I was that obsessive. And those 2 years coincided with me winning the British Quiz Championships in 2019. But one thing I've decided after that is I've achieved what I need to achieve. I need to focus on quality of life. As for me, quality of life now is learning facts because you want to know them and then hoping that they come up. But I'm not nearly as... This all comes down to Parkinson's and readjusting the priorities in your life. As long as I'm good enough to be a chaser, as long as I'm good enough to be a really good chaser and do really well on Beat the Chasers, then the rest of it is up to me as to how much I want to engage in learning facts. And I feel that I don't have necessarily the same obsessive passion that took me to the British Quiz title in 2019 as I do now, because there are younger kids with fresher, juicier, more absorbent brains that are just killing it in quiz at the moment. And if you look at the top 30 quizzes in the world now and compare it to the top 30 quizzes in the world 5 or 6 years ago, they are so much younger. Number one, because they've got absorbent brains. Number two, they've got hunger. And number three, the younger quizzers grew up with the internet. They grew up with access to the world. And the best time to learn facts is when you're younger, because they're the ones that stick. And so we've got a brilliant generation of younger quizzers coming through now. And you go, yeah, but I've got a life.
I know that you've spoken before about how your perspective changed after your diagnosis with Parkinson's back in 2019, which makes complete sense. You know, suddenly time is a luxury, isn't it? You know, you want to make the most of the time that you have while your health is good.
Absolutely. And part of that is very much quizzing, because I love quizzing and I love taking part and I'm still very competitive at it, but I'm not quite as good as I once was because the world has got better. And I don't mind. I don't, because it's about playing to the premise of what you want your life to be. And as long as you're enjoying the process of quizzing and finding new facts and finding out new information, as long as it makes you happy, that's far more important than whether you should have scored two more points in a written quiz that you did a couple of weeks ago than you did, or that. But I'll leave that to the young, that level of emotional analysis to the younger quizzers now. They can have it. Because I've got other things to be getting on with in my life.
Where are the pleasure pockets in life now? The places that you hadn't expected to find great joy?
I think a lot of this is down to the philosophy of aesthetics. My husband likes brutalist architecture. I love Renaissance churches. We see things in different ways, and it makes me realise that you can see beauty in a lot of things. So I like architecture and art a lot, as does my husband, but we both have very different tastes. So I get a lot of pleasure out of going to art galleries, but not just old-fashioned ones, but things like the Tate Modern, which is not as much my thing, but I enjoy seeing new ideas and new ideas expressed. I get great joy in watching Netflix comedies that I would never have picked up. Because they're American, they never made it to our screens necessarily without the streaming telly. I get a lot of joy out of Spotify. Not necessarily new music, because I think that takes a bit of time to digest into your head. But exploring the music that makes, you know, I'm constantly reading Facebook threads where people go, name your favourite song or name your favourite band. And if I've never heard of them, I go and explore their music. And suddenly the next thing I know, I'm absolutely loving it. I'm waxing lyrical about Fontaine's DC, whereas old me would never have heard of Fontaine's DC. Yeah. I get a pleasure out of various things. I still very much like drinking and meeting strangers after gigs. I like going to nice bars in towns and cities across the country and hanging out with people that just see me do comedy and finding out about their lives and making connections.
Which is something you've always done, isn't it? You like to have a drink with your audience after.
Yes, yeah. And I think that's part of building up a relationship.
It's quite unusual, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know what? I spent much of my late 20s and early 30s not getting into bars and clubs because I've become the sort of person the bar people took one look at and go, he doesn't look quite glamorous enough to come into our venue. So I quite like the fact that it's been subverted now and that I'm seen as a minor celebrity and I can get into bars and clubs. Ever since I've been on The Chase, it's the first time I've been able to live my dreams of being somebody that's just let into places. Because as a gay man, you know, you're dead at 25.
Is that right?
Unless you're on the telly, your life is finished at 25, according to the gay scene. It's a very ageist scene. So I remember
in reverse.
Yeah, I was in my late 20s when I first started noticing that I was not getting into bars that I used to be able to waltz into quite easily. And so I enjoy that side of, you know, the seedy underbelly, I suppose, if you like, of city life. I like going to towns. I was in Wakefield earlier this year. And to my amazement, because Wakefield is not an especially attractive town city, town centre, there were some really great bars. There's this whole street of really nice bars, and I just thought, this is what I like. This is what makes me happy.
And you're just doing more of what makes you happy now.
Yes, but that's really, really important, regardless of whether you've got Parkinson's or not. And we don't, you know. A lot of us had plans going into 2020 that the pandemic just took care of, and we have no idea what future disasters, whether it's viral or military, may befall society as a whole in the next few years. I think it's important to speed up access to your bucket list of dreams and make sure that you achieve them before other things get in your way. I'm lucky enough to not have a bucket list. I don't consider there's anything on my list that of things I'd like to do that I'm desperate to do or that I'll push everything out of the way in order to achieve it, because I feel that the main things now have been ticked off and I can just get on with enjoying life in a sort of slightly smug, self-satisfied way.
Good for you. I look forward to hearing that play out at Edinburgh. You're up there for how many weeks?
The whole run. August the 2nd to sometime 3.5 weeks later. I only once have I ever gone up to the Edinburgh and done a small run, and I didn't enjoy it at all, because you don't feel that you're... I like to feel part of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. There's something intensely masochistic about wanting to do the whole run, knowing that you're going to finish exhausted and ready to drop. But that's exactly how I'd like to feel at the end of the festival, is that I've done the whole run. Because I want to prove to the world that it can be done, even when you're fighting a disease, that you can still be the comedian that you want to be. And it's really, really important to me that I prove that.
How has your work had to change, Paul? Do you have to think differently, rehearse more? You tell me.
It's changed in unexpected ways. I mean, I choose not to drive, which means that my husband has become my personal assistant as a result. That's one, and I have to take gigs on bearing that in mind. Secondly, there's more of a don't give a damn about the jokes. It's just like I'm here now for a few years. I don't know how many gigs I've got left of me. I'm just going to enjoy myself and not worry about in my head about whether this is the audience's thing or not. are quite carefree with my jokes. And the biggest change is that I started doing music at about 3 years. There's a brilliant comedian and musician called Vicky Stone, who I was on a gig with about 3 or 4 years ago, just after I'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and she plays the keyboard. And I noticed how light her keyboard was. And I asked her what keyboard it is, and I bought the same make. And ever since then, I've been doing songs in my comedy shows. And last year was the first real big test at the Edinburgh Festival, because it was the first time that I was getting critics to see my songs. And they were broadly really supportive. And it was just such a... To create a new genre for yourself this late in your career was just really, really exciting. So there'll be songs at Edinburgh. And I know that I'm not a good singer, but I think fundamentally with musical comedy, you can make that not matter.
Yeah.
Because it's the words.
I think
one review 2 years ago said he's no Tim Minchin. And I said, with respect, I'm not trying to be Tim Minchin. Tim Minchin is the genius multimillionaire creator of Matilda the Musical. I'm not trying to be him.
I'm the cinnamon, I'll have you know.
Yeah.
But we all do our own thing our own way, right?
Well, exactly.
And you found that what's lovely is that you found the courage to try new things and not care, really, what people think.
Yeah, I think if I'm being completely cynical, the Parkinson's does give you a cushion. It gives you a cushion of audience respect because they go, yeah, we understand why you can't see.
He's a bit rubbish, but he has got Parkinson's. In terms of your singing, by the way, not your comedy.
It does give you a little bit of a cushion, but then you've got to use what you've got. Comedy is all about being the comedian that only you can be. And I can't ignore the fact that I've got Parkinson's, and I can't not write jokes about it. That's not to say that's what the show's about. It really isn't. But it's all informed by that. The whole show is informed by the fact that I'm openly gay, British Asian, qualified doctor, competitive quizzer, Parkinson's disease, and plenty more besides, exactly.
Oh, well, it's been really lovely talking to you rather than trying to be not thrashed by you. And I really hope that you enjoy Edinburgh and that every day those 400 people know how lucky they are to hear you become the poor man's Tim Minchin.
The poor man's Tim Minchin, the poor man's David Furnish. Enjoy a happy
Poundland.
Marriage
to you. Poundland's David Furnish.
David Furnish. Thank you very much, Kate. Thank you.
If you are heading up to the Edinburgh Fringe, make sure you check out Paul's show. It's called Paulie Bengali. Tickets are available now wherever you get your tickets. And for more great chat from equally curious and funny minds, you can find episodes with Anne Hegarty and Sean Wallace from The Chase in our back catalogue, as well as fellow doctor turned comic Adam Kay, comedian Adam Hills. We've got Daisy May Cooper, Kerry Godleyman and Rob Brydon, to name but a few. I'll be back on Tuesday with another midweek visit to the White Wine Question Time cellar. Until then, thanks for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app and hit subscribe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.